Distance. Hello out there, and welcome to Damn the Distance, a brand new, as of today, theater podcast from Oregon State University. I'm Elizabeth Hellman, OSU Theater Arts Area Coordinator and the University Theater Artistic Director. So, Liz, what are we doing here? The heck is this podcast for? Well, when we were told back in March that due to the COVID-19 pandemic, we would not actually be able to hold classes in person or stage public performances, our theater faculty had to radically rethink how we teach our students, how to devise ways to keep them creatively engaged, and how to continue to offer them a quality theater arts education at a distance. This is clearly not an ideal situation. It's one that performing arts organizations and educational institutions are facing all over the world. We are currently living under conditions where we cannot actually do theater. That is, we cannot share a physical space with an audience in real time. Theater is, and always has been, a collaborative form of public assembly defined by the living and breathing relationship between the spectator and the performer. And right now, in this moment, we cannot do the one thing that unifies all forms of theater, in that we cannot breathe the same air as others. At least, we should not be doing that. Wear your masks, people. So, what can we do? Well, we can find ways to continue to keep our students writing and performing and directing, designing, telling stories, and learning. And it's pretty exciting, and it's been challenging. This podcast was developed for a few reasons, beyond damning the distance that COVID has caused, and hopefully it can continue to be a way of connecting to our students and audiences even after this crisis is over. Damn the Distance is, first of all, a platform to release our student projects and university theater productions while the bans on public gatherings are in place. Rather than attempt a socially distant staging of our planned spring productions over Zoom or another streaming platform, we look to the past for inspiration and have adapted these works into radio plays. We are currently collaborating with OSU music production and composition students on these projects, and we're really, really excited to share our work with you in the next coming weeks. Apart from providing a place to share the work of our students with the public in these socially distant times, I also thought this could be a really great way of connecting our university theater patrons and students and provide background information on upcoming events and interviews with production designers and directors. Lastly, I thought that we could take this opportunity to share the perspectives of industry professionals through conversations about what different career paths in the arts look like and give advice to people starting out in the business. Basically, I just want to talk about what inspires theater artists in good times and bad times. OSU Theater is a community of artists striving to understand the human experience through the study and practice of theater. We are committed to that mission and a vision for a more empathetic and creatively engaged world now and into the future. So, on that note, I'm happy to introduce our first guest, Dr. Craig Willis. Craig joined OSU Theater's spring term as the guest director of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. He earned his MFA in directing and his PhD in dramatic literature and theory at the University of Oregon. Currently, he is the producing artistic director at the Oregon Contemporary Theater in Eugene, Oregon, an organization he has led since 2003. So, hello, Craig, and welcome to our podcast. You are our first guest.
Thanks, Liz.
Okay. I have some questions for you that I thought might be interesting for our students to hear you talk about in terms of what it is you do and how you got into it and those sorts of relevant theater sort kinds of questions. So looking way, way, way back in the Wayback Machine of your life, what initially drew you to the theater?
I remember the first time I walked onto a set from backstage at my high school. It was actually, I was in junior high, but I was visiting the high school. And I walked from backstage where I saw all this rough carpentry and then walked onto the set and I was in a living room. And I just liked that magical transportation of making something look real that isn't quite.
Do you remember the show?
I don't, unfortunately. I wasn't in it, and I was, like I say, I was in eighth grade, and I was visiting one of my friends who was slightly older, was involved in this production, and you know, and so that's.
Do you remember your first experience being on stage?
Well, you know, the very first experience as an actor was a production when I was in, I believe, eighth grade. I was part of a kind of gifted students' language arts class, and we took it upon ourselves to produce an original adaptation of The Story of Peter Rabbit.
Adorable.
We produced it as a, you know, theater piece that we then performed for younger kids. And I think I was originally Farmer McGregor. But even then, I quickly moved from being an actor to kind of being a director, producer. I like to tell people what to do. So,
do you think that's always been a part of your personality?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I feel pretty similar. I was the bossy one in the neighborhood and bossing all the boys around. So that eventually drew me to directing. So in high school, did you sort of associate yourself with like one of the theater kids and were involved with everything? Or was
I entered high school as a music kid. I was a band kid. I played French horn and mellophone and marching band and was very involved in journalism. And it was actually one of my high school English teachers freshman year who, because I had this voice that I still have at that time, he said, you should audition for the play. And okay. And I learned that a couple friends of mine were auditioning for the play. And so I auditioned and lo and behold, I got cast. And haven't stopped doing theater. Well, it's not entirely true. Have mostly not stopped doing theater since. So that was 40 years ago.
So when you went into college then, did you go in as a theater major with the intention of studying or working professionally in the theater at all? Or
no.
Oh, no. Not at all.
I started college as a math major. And thinking I was going to go into computer science, which was very new and evolving at that point. I was very good at math, and it seemed practical to me. I quickly learned I hated my math classes, although I was told later that if I'd stayed with it longer, they would become creative. My problem was that it didn't feel like there was much creativity or actually even much critical analysis happening. I literally was kind of spending 2 or 3 hours a day memorizing how to do certain math problems and coming back on Fridays and regurgitating that. And yeah, so I kind of let the math thing fall to the side, and I started doing theater immediately in college. And so I quickly shifted to being a theater and English major.
Where were you? What school?
Western Washington University in Bellingham.
Ah, yes. So you grew up in Washington. You've always been in the Northwest. Yep.
I have. Yeah, I've not always been here, but I did grow up here and lived here, apart from 1 year spent working for a theater for young audiences in Sunnyvale, California. Close to where you went to college, very, very close. And then I spent a couple of years working for a ballet company in Ohio. So, but other than that, I've lived mainly in Oregon and Washington.
Okay. One of the reasons I was actually really looking forward to having this conversation with you is we've known each other for a long time, but I don't think we've ever really, I don't know, talked about your background or your methodology or anything like that. So this is kind of exciting. So we met at University of Oregon.
So it was my second stint, as I recall.
Yes, the second time. So you went in with the intention of studying to get an MFA at the time in directing. Yes or no?
Although when we met, I think I was working on my PhD.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. The first time.
Yeah. No, I originally. What happened was after I got my BA, mm-hmm. which was in theater and English, minor in English. I went to work for a children's theater company, didn't really like that job. And that job, oddly enough, led me to a job as a company manager with a ballet company in the Midwest. I really liked my job with a ballet company, and I liked the people of the Midwest. I didn't really like the weather, particularly summers, which were, you know, muggy and buggy. And I started getting an itch to be doing theater again and to be back in the Northwest. I've often said it's a, you know, it's a blessing and a curse to have been born and raised in the Northwest. You know, the blessing is that it's a beautiful, wonderful place. The curse is that you don't really feel happy living anywhere else. So when I decided I would go back to get my MFA, I had right out of my undergrad program, I had been accepted into a couple of very good MFA programs in stage management, actually, and opted instead to take this job in California. But going back several years later, I decided I would do directing, because that was always my intention. I'm just old enough to have fallen into that period. You know, 30, 40 years ago, it was kind of an expected progression in order to become a director that you would be a stage manager first. That's not true at all anymore. So when I decided the second time to just look at MFA programs, I limited myself to schools between Palo Alto, California and Vancouver, Canada. So I essentially applied to UBC, UW, University of Oregon, and Stanford. And I ended up at the U of O.
Well, that's where I ended up. Strangely enough, I also limited myself to the West Coast because I too know the advantages of here.
Yes. Now, if I were going back, for your students out there, if I were 22, 23, looking at grad school now, I would really look at the top-notch programs, because ultimately, I think what grad school can provide you with beyond opportunities to learn more and experiment more and practice more are connections. And the connections that you can get at a very top-notch school, where the faculty have amazing connections, the alumni have amazing connections, and the people you're going to school with will eventually have amazing connections, might propel your career farther. But that's just my bias these days.
Sure. Do you feel that in what you're doing now that grad school was really a necessary step for you? Or looking back, do you think you could have been where you are without it?
I probably could have gotten here different ways. I mean, I know people who have great careers and didn't either finish an undergrad program or a grad program. But I mean, some of the most successful people I know do not have graduate degrees. In fact, you were going to be directing a play, not for COVID-19, by one Miss Heidi Schreck, I think an alumnus of the University of Oregon, circa 1993 or 94. And she never went to graduate school, but she's now an Obie Award-winning actor and Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-nominated playwright. So there you go.
Well, there you go. So you liked grad school, though, so much the first time you decided to go back a second time.
Well, so after I finished grad school the first time, for a couple of reasons, largely personal, I opted to not, again, I had been accepted into a very good PhD program and opted not to follow that track, which would have taken me to Chicago, and instead moved to Seattle, and was doing some self-produced theater, but, you know, accidentally landed into what turned out to be a 7-year career as a salesperson with a Fortune 500 company that was very lucrative. It was the 90s. It was a great time to be a salesperson. But towards the end of my time there, I had gone on vacation with a couple of old friends, and we went to New York together, one of the friends that was with me was not really that much of a theater goer. The other one was almost exclusively a musical theater attendee. And I convinced them to go with me to see Brian Dennehy in Death of a Salesman. We went to see a matinee. And here I am watching a play I'd seen and read who knows how many times previously and seeing it masterfully performed. And I suddenly realized when we get to the scene where Willie Loman is talking to his boss, his boss is paying no attention to him because his boss is preoccupied with his new dictation equipment that he's so excited about. And what I was selling at that time was dictation equipment. So here I am watching a play about a salesman who is being ignored by the arrival of this dictation equipment, and I'm selling dictation equipment. And that and a couple of other things convinced me maybe I should give up the sales thing and go back into theater. So, and then I ended up calling my old mentor at the University of Oregon, telling him I was having this quandary. And I thought about going to the University of Washington because I was living in Seattle. Would have been very easy if I had gotten in. Except for the University of Washington's program is very much, or was at that time, very much, if you were in the PhD track, it was very theoretical and not much practice. And I knew, of course, Oregon's program was a good blend. And so we had a conversation about the pros and cons of all of this. And then at the end of the conversation, my advisor, Grant McKerney, said, oh, and by the way, we've just had somebody drop out of the program and I can offer you a full ride immediately. So.
Well then.
So that, you know, that was September. I ended up not really coming until January, but that was why I came back to grad school and why I ended up back at Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, I was really grateful to the U of O program for that similar reason, that I can't imagine studying theater and basically hearing welcome to the library, we'll see you in 5 years, you know, and
yeah.
Practice it just seems awful, I mean, to me. So obviously people pursue that kind of work, but the blending and the balance was really, really important. So
yeah, practice and theory are a good blend, I think.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good for the art. It's good for the soul. So right now, and since 2003, you have been leading the Oregon Contemporary Theater, although it wasn't called that quite yet in 2003.
Nope, 2013.
No, 2013.
That's why I became Oregon Contemporary Theater. Yeah, it was a Lord Liebrich Theater Company until 2013.
So you are now, your title is a producing artistic director. And you, is this the first artistic director position that you've had in your career, or?
Yeah, other than like you know, I did start a very small theater company in Seattle. We just produced a couple of shows. And so I guess theoretically I was the artistic director of that. But yeah, I think in terms of really real jobs, yes.
Is this some kind of like, was this a position or a role in the arts that you sort of aspired to when you were younger, or is it something you discovered along the way?
No, I mean, I think if you'd asked me on the day that I graduated from college as an undergraduate, what do you want to be when you grow up? It was artistic director of a theater company.
Okay.
In fact, I went to work. I went to work for a theater company immediately after graduation and was so excited because I really just thought, yeah, this is what I want to do.
What is it about the job that
There were several places along the way where I thought, no, it's not at all what I want to do. Well, I mean, I like that I get to control what it is the company produces, which to me over the many years has felt to me like it's an opportunity. It's like a curatorial position. I'm curating what I see as a conversation between a group of theater artists and a community. And the group of artists starts with the playwright, but then the other layers get added on, the director and the designers and the actor. And I, you know, selfishly, and yeah, I mean, I really enjoy that role of choosing what the where the conversation is going to go. And I think it's one of the reasons the company has been successful is that I think I have a pretty good sense of the conversation that our audience wants to have, or conversations that they want to engage in, I guess.
Right. Like you know your Eugene audience.
Yeah.
Specifically, and you would curate perhaps a different experience if you were running a theater in Seattle or Los Angeles.
Yeah, and or a theater that had a different sensibility to it. I've thought about applying at times, like what would it be like, for example, if I were the artistic director of, I'm trying to think of something that your audience might be familiar with, but if I was the artistic director, the examples I'm going to use are not familiar to the audience. So I'll just say the Village Theater it's in Issaquah, Washington. It's a suburb of Seattle. It's a very highly respected and well-known theater, but it largely does musicals and does very warm and friendly, easy audience entertainment. Not exclusively, but mostly. And I don't know if I would like it or not. It might be fun for a while, but I think I would get bored with it more quickly.
When you took over at Lord Liebrich, I mean, was the experience one, because you have a relationship, they have a board of directors,
yep,
as a nonprofit. And was it like, okay, Craig, do whatever you want? Or did they have a vision that you felt you kind of had to support? Or what was that experience?
Well, certainly part of the interview process was to ask them to, they asked me to provide a list of, I don't think they even capped it, but they certainly wanted, what are the kinds of plays you envision producing if you get this job? What are the things that you'd want to produce that you think should be produced? And I think one of the reasons I applied for the job is that the theater, to that point, it was a little over 10 years old at that point, and it had, over its history, produced things that I found interesting. It produced largely a combination of modern reimaginings of classic work, largely Shakespeare, as alongside some of the better plays coming out of contemporary theater, and sometimes some modern classics along the way. And all of that appealed to me. So, yeah.
So in a non-COVID time, because I'm sure your job is probably very different right now, but ordinarily, what is day-to-day life like for an artistic director of a theater of this size?
In an ideal world, my focus would be on keeping abreast of new trends in playwriting and trying to be aware of emerging writers. And I accomplished that somewhat by reading, a lot by attending play festivals. And I serve as a reader on a couple of play competitions. So that forces me to read new works that other people feel strongly about, so strongly that they're submitting them to a competition.
Right.
And so that's part of the job, is staying abreast of the industry. A large part of the job is shepherding the board, our board of directors, whose responsibility primarily are to be good ambassadors for the theater and the community, to help advise me in my leadership capacity, and to, you know, be patrons and donors and to encourage others to do the same. Because, a good friend of mine refers to the kind of work I do as church work. Her father is a Episcopalian priest, and she grew up in the church, recognizing the large part of what a priest or, you know, clergyman does is try to encourage the flock to give generously to the church to help support the church. So that's a lot of what I do.
Right.
Particularly, actually, I would say that's the focus of my job right now in this post-COVID world, is give generously to keep us alive. But then also hiring talented people such as yourself to be directors and designers, and trying to stay abreast of the talent that is both available to me locally, and as our budgets have grown and we can afford to bring in outside guest artists, then, you know, who regionally should I be aware of that, you know, we might be able to bring in?
So what are some perhaps like skills or things that you think you bring to the table that make you a good artistic director?
I think I have a really good
job, Craig.
I have a really good aesthetic, both for choosing good plays, but also choosing teams of people that work well together, and helping to make sure they have the resources they need. So I think it's I see myself in life generally as somebody who is really good at connecting people. It's kind of why I, you know, loathe and hate and love Facebook all at the same time, because ultimately I do like bringing people together, and sometimes that is a good tool for doing that. So yeah.
Bringing the people together. You touched on the idea of aesthetic, and this is something that I actually talk to my students a lot about, is kind of a developing an awareness of what your personal aesthetic is and what your interests are. And sort of in your experience, and as you were developing as a young director, what kinds of like writers or other directors or even films or books, what kinds of things do you think really shaped your perspective and your aesthetic growing up?
So I would say that, you know, I'm a very visual person, and I'm a lazy person. So I like clear, direct stories that are easy to follow. I like writers who have distinct voices. And it's interesting because I just heard somebody who is kind of renowned in the world of play analysis, a gentleman named David Ball, who wrote a great book called Backwards and Forwards. It's a very seminal text in terms of script analysis. It's simple, direct, easy approach to text analysis. And he said one of the things that he left out of the book, that if you were rewriting the book today, he would include, is voice. And by which he means, when a playwright writes, the characters should each have very distinct voices. We shouldn't have to look at the name of the character on the page to know who's talking. And I find that as I read plays all the time, it's one of the first things that'll make me put a script down, is if I'm having to constantly refer back to the cast of characters,
right,
then I don't have a clear idea of who these people are. So I want that distinction to be easy. I want to be, I tend to like a blend of comedy and tragedy. I like plays that make you laugh and then give you a gut punch sometimes.
Yeah, I would agree. We have a similar aesthetic, I think, right? So... is there any writer, any playwright that really captured your imagination again and again over the years? Or do you just kind of like a lot of different things?
I like a lot of different writers. I feel like I need to go back. I have been, like a lot of people, listening to Zoom conversations amongst people I admire that are being put out into the ether for us to enjoy. And it's made me think I need to go back and revisit Shakespeare. I always kind of whisper to people, since I have a PhD in theater, it's like, yeah, but I don't really like Shakespeare. And I learned actually about 20 years ago, I think the problem is that I, like many people, have just been bludgeoned to death with really bad productions of Shakespeare.
Oh yeah, no, that's...
And so that if Shakespeare is well done, it can make all the difference. It just doesn't happen enough. So I feel like I should give him a second chance.
That'd be generous of you.
Well, actually, because I think it might be fun to try and adapt some of his plays to a modern, you know, not that this would be in any way original, but it might be a fun challenge for me to like take on and imagine, you know, how does King Lear work in a post President Number 45 world, you know, imagining that person dividing his kingdom amongst his children. But
I think you're onto something, Dr. Willis.
In terms of writers that I've grown up with, I was coming of age when David Mamet was emerging. And, you know, the sad thing is now I think the man personally is not somebody who I have a lot of admiration for, but I still think he's a great writer. Mm-hmm. And some of, you know, his plays are amazing. I think I've always been a fan of William Inge and Tennessee Williams and Lillian Hellman. More recently, you know, current living writers that I really admire, Lauren Gunderson. And I'm totally enamored of an unproduced playwright named Clarence Koo. And I did hear in that same conversation that led me to rethink Shakespeare, something that person was giving advice to people was the reality that many great plays never get produced.
Right.
And I think that's true. I know for myself, sometimes there are plays that I really want to produce, and for a variety of reasons, it doesn't happen. Sometimes because the playwright's agent is waiting for a big New York theater company or a big regional theater company to produce their work. So they don't want a small theater in Eugene, Oregon to have an opportunity. And by the time they are ready to give me the opportunity, my interests and reasons for wanting to produce the play originally have changed and evolved. You know, just things don't click at the right time for people. But I think there are lots of great writers and obviously great actors who get passed along. But
yeah, timing is kind of everything. And I think we know that as we're living in an interesting time where timing has affected a lot of things. So kind of jumping back a little bit to, one of the things that I think is so wonderful about the theater is that we have the opportunity to be able to speak to a specific audience or a specific community. It's not a homogenous art form. Unlike film, they want to make films for everybody, and theater, we can really create something for our own audiences. How would you define what the performing arts culture is like in, you know, Oregon or even the Northwest versus other places in this country? Like, what are we doing a little differently, do you think?
I think the Northwest and the West Coast both tend to be probably a little bit or maybe a lot more progressive than other parts of the country. Probably a little bit more highly educated. And then, of course, both where I am in Eugene and where you are in Corvallis, we're in college towns, and they're very highly progressive and well-educated. So those are big. And I grew up in Bellingham, which is another Northwest college town, right? There's a part of our communities that are stuck in 1968. And but it feels like I think we're moving beyond that. Though I would also say one of the challenges we have in the Northwest is that, as a good friend of mine who went to school also at the University of Oregon, although earlier than you, this is somebody who grew up outside of Boston and has lived in New York for the last 50 years, except for a brief period of window going to school in Nebraska and then Oregon. He lovingly refers to the Northwest as the land of Caucasia. And that is, you know, a reality we have to face, which is that our region is far less ethnically diverse than a lot of the country. Although I think we spend a lot of time, thankfully, trying to consider that in what we produce and how we produce it. And So there's a lot of work that we do that needs to be done in our region in terms of advancing equity, diversity, and inclusion in the stories we tell.
Absolutely. So you've been at OCT or Lord Liebrich for the last 17 years. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank
you. You can have your driver's license now.
first legal drink. That's great.
So what's changed the most about that organization in this time?
Me. I mean, I think I'm a much better leader of that kind of an organization. But the organization itself, I mean, the budget is almost five times what it was when I started, and the staff is five times what it was when I started, and I think the caliber of work we do is five times what it was when I started. I think it was good. I inherited a good, solid company in terms of artistic quality. It was a very poorly managed company in terms of business. Mm-hmm. In my first year, I went to the then board president and recommend we stop operations because we were in debt and I didn't see a good way to get out of it. Then somebody who had the means to get rid of our debt did so and said, okay, now you figure it out going forward. So, yeah.
Good timing.
Yeah, although it was a lot of pressure. It felt like a lot of pressure then.
Right. So what do you think has changed the most about your approach to directing since you first started? Like, how are you different as a director when you get a cast, when you get a text, text?
I actually hope, and I think this might be one of the positive things that comes out of COVID-19 for me, is that I will go back into putting more advanced work into my directing. I am so busy with other aspects of my life that I feel like directing has been shortchanged sometimes. I probably should go back and reread some of the books that I felt were really inspiring and important to me, to see how I feel about them now. And, you know, those books would include Peter Brook's An Empty Space and Peter Hall's Diaries. And I don't think a lot has ultimately changed. I mean, I firmly believe that the primary role of the director is, one, to make sure you're working with a really good script, if you have that luxury of choice. A lot of directors, like you, I hand you a script and say, here, direct it. Fortunately, I have good taste. But then it's like, you know, so you need a good script and you need a good cast, and then you need to get out of the way, is how I feel to some extent.
Although,
it's not entirely true. I think some of the things that have influenced me as a director that I would never have imagined, I spent several years working as the company manager for a ballet company. And I worked, part of that job was that I went to every technical rehearsal for the ballet company, both at home and on the road. So it ends up being a lot of tech rehearsals. And I learned a lot about timing and meter, and especially how light affects movement. And there's just things I'd never thought of in terms of the importance of how fast a light cue happens or what happens in a light cue that really shape how an audience experiences time, and which is a lot of what a director controls beyond maybe telling the actors where to move, is the rhythm and tempo. And light and sound are incredible components of that. And so both having good collaborators in those areas, but also taking the time to make sure that their work works, I guess.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, like, in a certain way, directors were editors, of a process.
And I often warn my casts early on that I don't have time to reward all of the positive things you're going to do.
Yes.
My job is primarily to get rid of the things that aren't working. And, you know, so you're going to hear a lot of, don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Stop doing that.
Why are you doing that?
Don't do that. But, yeah.
So you said a little bit about you get so busy with other areas of your life that you hadn't been focusing enough on directing. Or what is it like to balance life with the kind of work that you do? Is it a struggle all the time?
I would say that, you know, when I first started in this job 17 years ago, and I first started going to national conferences with other people doing this job, almost always in the list of breakout sessions that you can go to at a national conference is going to be questions of work-life balance, because it oftentimes does not exist.
Right.
And you have to figure that out. And I've seen a variety of people do it different ways. For myself, I think I personally would always suggest that don't marry another theater person. But then again, I also know couples who are quite successfully and happily married, and they're both theater artists. And yeah.
No, it's a question. I don't know. I have students, of course, you know, they imagining their lives, you know, 10 or 15 years from now. And, you know, a lot of them want to get married. They want families. They want, you know, to have sort of stability in their lives. And I mean, do you think that is generally something that is possible, or is it something you have to make choices about? Or, I mean, what is the reality like?
I think it's hard.
Yeah.
I think I applaud that there are companies who have made very conscious choices to try and achieve that for their workers. And Oregon Shakespeare Festival is a great example of that. I mean, they purposefully looked around and realized, well, that a lot of people who work for us can't really afford to put a life together. So the company went about trying to improve that circumstance for a lot of their employees. And now, unfortunately, they are in this place where they're having to rethink their business model because, you know, they grew too big too fast and it's not balancing out. I think, you know, it's the old advice that I've heard given by many, 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 many people is that if you can imagine yourself doing anything else and being happy, then you should do that, because this is a hard life. Not many people really are able to pay their bills doing what we do. And I feel extremely fortunate that I can, but, you know.
Yeah. Craig Willis, former math major.
What had, you know, I jokingly talk about the fact that I'm old enough to have been dating somebody who graduated from college with a computer science degree, and I encouraged them. They had two job choices in front of them. One was going to work for Thurston County, which is the county where Olympia, Washington is. And that sounded very reasonable and smart to me. Their other choice was going to work for this little known company I'd never heard of called Microsoft. Yeah. And they went to work for Microsoft. Imagine.
That's how things work out for them.
they've been retired for 20 years. They're on to their next career now.
Oh, that's lovely. So you have been on board with us at OSU this last spring term to direct our production of The Importance of Being Earnest, and it's been wonderful to have you as a guest director. And actually, you're familiar with some of our students have come down and worked at OCT, which has been a wonderful opportunity for them to have those kinds of experiences. So obviously, originally, we wanted to stage this production, and we still intend on staging the production. Fingers crossed beyond the COVID. But what have you ever had an experience similar to this as a director, where you've had to like work distantly with the cast? I mean, you know, what's that experience been like for you in this environment? I know so much is new for all of us right now. So
yeah, no, it's fascinating. Like, you just think about the last 8 weeks, I have suddenly, in addition to what I did for you guys, I have since directed a play for a theater company in San Francisco, mm-hmm. where two of the actors were in New York City. One of the actors was in the East Bay. The playwright was in, you know, New Haven, Connecticut. Right. And, you know, I was like, what are we doing? But so, no, I've not done anything like this before that I can think of. I mean, I've come in as a guest artist in situations, but never tried to work with people via, you know, Brady Bunch style TV screen approach to theater. So it's been fun. I think it was actually, the timing was great in that I think it was kind of comforting for most of us who were involved to have something creative to look forward to at the end of our days, you know, because we were rehearsing in the evenings. And so I don't know what those poor students had been doing during the day. some of them cramped in very small spaces, I think, you know, in terms of dorm rooms or apartments that, where they were trying to be socially distant from roommates sometimes. And so I think the rehearsals were kind of a breath of air for us all.
Has this experience taught you anything as a director or an artistic director? Or can you just not wait for it to be over?
I mean, it's fascinating because I think we're going to live with it for a while in various ways. And I actually started realizing as I was working with the actors, you know, a couple weeks into the process that, yeah, I think I could start to, it's been a long time since I taught an acting class, but I started realizing how I could adapt some of the exercises I used to do in acting classes for a Zoom approach to teaching acting. the worst part about it was just the limitations of technology, in that we were reliant on various people having different equipment to connect to the conversation and different bandwidths. So, you know, sometimes there were breaks and stutters and or just distortions. But especially when you're dealing with a play that is very textually rich and you're dealing with trying to teach actors a dialect, and, you know, sometimes being able to clearly understand them and hear them is a challenge via Zoom. But.
Yeah. So do you approach directing a little bit differently when you're working with students than in a professional atmosphere? Or,
well, I honestly, it had been almost 18 years since I'd worked with students before this. I mean, exclusively students. I've worked with students as parts of other casts a lot, but to work exclusively with students again, I guess I take that back. I had done a production about probably 14 years ago that utilized almost exclusively college students, but it was in a non-college setting, so it felt like the rules were a little different. I just think that although the students were fine, I just realized there's probably I needed to not have the same expectations in some ways. And largely in this case, that I also, it's been a long time since I've directed a play that was done almost entirely in dialect, mm-hmm. and without the advantage of having somebody else whose job it is to teach them the dialect, you know, or expecting that you're working with a group of actors who are coming in with a lot of dialect experience, you know. So that was the only thing I think that was remarkably different about working with the students than if I had just been working with a professional cast.
Yeah, yeah. I remember it was a long time ago, I had this question. Joseph Gilg, who you obviously know as well from U of O, he'd been directing something at Lord Liebrecht, but then also, you know, working at U of O and directing shows there. And I can't remember how we got into it. We were talking about it, and he said, it's so much fun to go into working at Lord Liebrecht or directing a professional show. You know, I'm not teaching people how to act. I'm just directing the play. I kind of feel that that's, of course, part of my responsibility in educational theater in the university too, is I'm teaching people how to be in a play as well as directing a play.
Yeah. No, there's definitely that. I mean, there's, you know, we have the luxury of being very selective about who we put into casts.
Right.
We're normally doing very small cast shows. And so there's usually not a lot of fundamental actor coaching that's happening at Oregon Contemporary Theater the way it's got to happen when you're dealing with undergrads who've, you know, this might be the second or third play they've done, you know.
Well, that's part of the fun, though, too, is seeing them. I think, you know, part of the excitement about doing this is getting to see people grow so much as actors after, you know, even a year or 2 years, and then 4 years, it's like you hardly recognize them anymore.
Yeah, or even just in the course of a single production, sometimes you see tremendous growth.
That's really exciting stuff. So, so as we're kind of winding down, what's some advice you would give to a young person who's, you know, they're going to be graduating sooner in the next couple of years and going out into the world, into the arts? And I mean, I know now they're entering a COVID world, but in a non-COVID
world. Yeah, what a strange time.
Yeah. You know, what are some things you think that they should, I guess, take with them or if they want to pursue a career like yours?
Well, sometimes trust that the universe is going to throw opportunities at you, and it's your job to be cognizant that that's happening and grab them. I would say, if you have a strong sense of what you are and, you know, want to be and what you want to do, then seek out mentors in that field and get good advice about how to pursue that. I think, you know, earlier in our conversation, I said, you know, curiously, I have ended up being exactly where I wanted to be 35 years ago, although I think I have gotten there accidentally as opposed to purposefully. And I think a purposeful approach to that might not have been as interesting, but it might have led to different kinds of success and or different kinds of experiences.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me and with our students today. And we can't wait to release Importance of Being Earnest.
Yeah, I'm excited too.
Yeah, Olivia's doing a bang up job, and I think it's going to come together. And I'm super excited. So perhaps we will have you come and maybe record us a short intro to it.
Sure.
But you'd have to use a British accent. So.
Certainly.
There we go. But, yeah. Actually, Andrew's recording me credits today and asked if he should do it in a British dialect. And I said, absolutely. 100%. So thank you so much, Craig.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for joining us on our very first episode of Damn the Distance with Oregon State University Theater. Please download and subscribe to our feed and tell your friends about us. And if you have any questions, comments, or would like to know more about supporting the work of OSU Theater, don't hesitate to contact us at damthedistance@oregonstate.edu. That's DAM, the distance, at oregonstate.edu. We'll be back next week with an interview with equity actress, educator, director, and all-around swell gal Inga Wilson to talk about making a life and a career in the theater. And in the next 2 weeks, we will finally be releasing our audio drama version of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. That's all for this week. Damn the Distance was written and hosted by me, Elizabeth Hellman, with amazing support from our rad theater students, featuring original music by Hannah Schwartz, sound editing and engineering by Josh Gassaway, and artwork by Robert Reeder. Thank you. And let's damn this distance together.
Damn!